Just to remind you, last time we considered the action for a particle traveling in space-time along some curve, and I argued that all you could do is really consider the length of the world line as the action, and you have to multiply by the mass to get a quantity with the right dimensions. So this really wasn't, there weren't many options for this action. And the conceptually simplest action is this one. Which is just the proper time along the integral d lambda times that, where x prime mu is dx mu d lambda. So this is just d tau, the proper time along the path. And we varied that action and recovered the geodesic equation in the affine parameterization. Okay, where the geodesic equation was x double dot mu plus gamma mu nu lambda x dot mu x dot lambda equals 0, and x dot mu is dx mu d tau. Okay, so it was kind of a messy derivation because that square root appeared all over the place. But the end result was very simple. One thing I'd like to point out to you is that this geodesic equation can also be written in another way. As u mu semicolon lambda u lambda equals 0, where u mu is dx mu d tor. So you can write it that way. The reason why, so u mu can be considered as the velocity, as the four velocity of the particles on a given geodesic, so four velocity of the part of one particle. It can also be considered as u mu of x, the local velocity of four velocity of a fluid of particles. Okay, so in this equation, you're supposed to regard u as a function of x. And so you should think of a fluid of particles traveling through space-time. And at each point in space-time, there's some particle going through that point, and u mu is its four velocity. Okay, so the reason why this equation is true is this equation reads, so u mu is dx mu u mu is dx mu d tor. So I'm supposed to think of that dx mu d tor as a function of x because it's the local velocity of the particles. In fact, let me write it this way. Let me write the geodesic equation this way, as u mu dot plus gamma mu nu lambda u nu u lambda equals 0. And then is what is u mu dot? Well, u mu dot is u mu comma lambda dx lambda d tor. Okay? So I think of, so u mu dot means d by d tor of u mu. And I think of u mu as a function of x of tor. Okay, so du mu d tor, I've got to differentiate u mu with respect to each of these arguments and then multiply by dx d tor. And so I get this expression. Okay, but dx d tor is just u lambda. So this is u mu comma lambda u lambda. Okay, and when I put this term together with here, then I get exactly this equation. So that's a useful equation, that if I've got a fluid of particles all following geodesics, then this equation is true. And so, for example, when you check for the covariance stress energy conservation of a fluid, the fluid stress energy depends on U, and you can use this equation to check that the fluid stress energy is conserved. Also, from this equation, you can see that this quantity for a fluid, g mu nu u mu u nu, okay, which is minus 1 for a particle, that the covariant derivative of this equals, multiplied by u lambda, is equal to 0. And so that means that this quantity, so I can see that because covariant derivative on the metric is 0. Covariant derivative on u mu, contracted with u lambda, just gives me this equation. So that's 0, and the same for u nu. Okay, so basically this means that this quantity is conserved along the fluid flow. Now, something else we did last time is we discussed an improved action. And this was given by m over 2 integral d lambda g mu nu of x. I'll call it x prime mu. This is dx d lambda again over e minus e. Where this e was defined to transform that e prime of lambda prime was equal to d lambda prime e of lambda. Okay, so this was this, E was a density, was called a tensor density. It didn't transform like a, scalar. And then varying this with respect to E, so delta S, delta E, varying S with respect to E gave me this equation, G mu nu, x prime nu over E squared equals minus 1. And that's equal to, and so you see from this that d tor is equal to E d lambda. Okay, because I'll just take these two d lambdas to the right-hand side, and I have E d lambda squared is minus that, minus g mu dx nu, take the square root, and I get this expression. Obviously, if I'd put a plus 1 here, I would have got a plus 1 there, and then I would be describing tachyons. So the action for a tachyon has a plus here. And the action for a null particle, a photon, just has a 0. Okay, so this goes to plus 1 for tachyons, which don't exist. and 0 for massless particles. And of course, for massless particles, you have to be careful because this m doesn't really mean very much. And so you can just absorb this m into the lambda. Absorb m into lambda.
Are you setting E to 0 for massless particles?
No.
You're just setting the coefficient of E.
Just this to 0. Yeah, that term is 0. Mm-hmm. So now when I vary with respect to E, I'm going to get this term is 0. If I vary this with respect to Z, I'm going to get minus delta E squared times G to U. X prime nu equals 0 for all delta E, so far as the physical 0, that's correct. But you don't want this parameter m hanging around, it doesn't mean anything for a massless particle, and so you can just absorb it into the lab. Okay, so this is actually a an easier action to use. And in fact, you can, the way to use it is often just to set E equal to 1. So, e.g., or you can set, so you see, when I vary with respect to E, I get this equation. But E is a free E is a free quantity. I mean, I the choice of E determines what lambda actually means. D tau is a physical thing. The choice of E determines what lambda means. So you can just choose E equals 1, and so lambda is tau, or d lambda is d tau. And then this action is fixed. Now I can vary it with respect to x, and I'll just get the geodesic equation. And then vary with respect to x to get the geodesic equation. Okay, so I just leave that as an exercise. If I take this action with e equals 1, and I vary with respect to x, so I just substitute x as x plus delta x, and I compute the coefficient of delta x, and I insist the action vanishes for any delta x, then I get the geodesic equation. Okay, in the affine parameterization, where lambda is tau. Okay, so now we're going to use this action to solve various problems. But before we do that, I want to point out that you can see conservation laws directly from the action. This is always the easiest way to infer conserved quantities. It's just straight from the action. So let's consider Well, okay, so we've set, let's imagine we've set E equal to 1. This is actually, let me just... this is for a massive particle. Okay, so let me say that. For a massive particle, when I have this, then I have this equation, and then I can use the fact that all of these statements are for a massive particle. So let's focus on that for now. So if I write down my action, so if E equals 1, then the action is m over 2 integral g mu x dot nu dtor minus 1. And now if I vary delta s with respect to delta x and set that to 0, then what I get is the geodesic equation. But in many problems, rather than actually work out the Christoffel symbols, it's easier just to work straight with the action. Okay, so say we're doing a particle in Schwarzschild. It's much simpler just to plug in the metric here. You don't have to calculate any Christoffel symbols. Plug the metric in here and vary this with respect to x, and you get the equations of motion directly. It's completely equivalent to working out the geodesic equation. Furthermore, you can see that if g mu nu is independent of some coordinate, okay, e.g. phi in the Schwarzschild metric, the metric was completely independent of phi, then when I vary the action with respect to phi and set the variation 0, I'm going to get this equation, d by d tor of g phi nu x dot nu equals 0. Okay, because if g is independent of phi, then when I vary g with respect to delta phi, when I calculate delta g in terms of delta phi, there'll be no coefficient of delta phi here. The only place delta phi occurs is here. So I'll get delta phi dot from one of these terms, right? So this will give me g mu phi delta phi dot x dot, g phi nu delta phi dot x dot nu. And then I'll just integrate by parts to put the derivative on the other two terms, and I'll get this equation. Okay? Yeah. It's not doing anything. No. Not doing anything. It's just there. It's just telling you this equation. Okay, so when you vary delta E and then set E equal to 1, you're just setting lambda equal to tau. But this term does not contribute to the equation for x at all. Okay, so we have, so every time you have a quantity that the metric is independent of, one of the coordinates, every time the metric is independent of one of the coordinates, there's a corresponding conserved quantity. Okay? And actually, if you think about it, it's the canonical momentum conjugate to theta. Okay, the definition of a canonical momentum, p mu, is d Lagrangian dx dot mu. And if an action is independent of some coordinate, then the corresponding canonical momentum is conserved. And this is, again, an example of Noether's theorem. Okay, so this saves a lot of work in solving the geodesic equation. You just need to know what coordinates is the metric independent of some coordinates. If it is, then the corresponding canonical momenta are conserved. So let's now do Schwarzschild. And somebody pointed out I'd forgotten an S in the name of Schwarzschild. Okay. It's Schwartz and then Schild. And so the Schwarzschild metric we derived a couple of lectures ago. And now let's consider the action for a particle in Schwarzschild. Okay. And I'm going to set gm over c squared equal to rs. Okay, that's a parameter, which is, in fact, 2gm over c squared. That's just a number in the metric. And it's a radius, in fact, by dimensions. And so we call it the Schwarzschild radius. Right, so the metric ds squared is minus 1 minus rs over r dt squared plus 1 minus rs over r inverse dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And this lot I'm often going to call d omega squared. It's just the metric on a two-sphere. Okay, so for a particle in Schwarzschild, we have an action. And I'm just going to use that the form where I've just set E equal to 1. And I'm going to drop the constant term because it doesn't matter for the geodesic equation. And so the action looks like this. Integral detour minus 1 minus rs over r t dot squared plus r dot squared over 1 minus rs over r plus r squared. Well, I guess this time I will write it out. OK, so that's the action for a particle in Schwarzschild. And now we will get the Lagrangian equations of motion. So vary this delta s equals 0. And so, of course, these equations are the same as d by dt of dl d theta dot equals dl d theta. OK, this is the Lagrange density. This whole thing here is the Lagrangian. And so this formula has done the integrations by parts. I think somebody wanted me to do it that way. So varying with respect to this, to theta, so delta s with respect to theta, obviously I get nothing from here, but I get something there. And so the left-hand side, the d by dt of dl d theta dot, will give me r squared theta dot dot I get a factor of 2 because it's theta dot squared. And I'll forget about m because it'll appear on the left and the right-hand side of the equation. And so this is equal to r squared. So now I vary with respect to this, and I get r squared sine theta cos theta phi dot squared. OK, so that's the equation of motion for theta. Yeah.
With respect to proper time, right?
Yes, it does.
And so in the Euler-Lagrange equation you've written there, is that it?
Oh, sorry, yeah, that's okay. Thanks.
Okay, so Euler-Lagrange is just completely equivalent to vary this thing, integrating by parts, and setting delta s to 0. Okay, so that's the theta equation of motion. But if you think about it, this metric is very symmetric. I mean, that's how we defined it. And so theta is this polar angle. Okay, and the equator is theta equals pi over 2. And just by the spherical symmetry, if a particle is moving in that equator, it's never going to leave the equator. Okay, so if you set theta equals pi over 2, that has to be a solution, and it'll be a solution for all time. And indeed, you can see from this equation that theta equals pi over 2 is a solution. Okay, so with spherical symmetry, you can put any geodesic into a plane without any loss of generality, and pick that plane to be theta equals pi over 2. OK, so that's just a convenience. So without loss of generality, you can put any geodesic into this plane, theta equals pi over 2, because of the spherical symmetry, We'll come to that. So I'm assuming m is positive for now. Okay, we're about to do bending of light, and we'll need to consider that case. But all I'm going to do is reabsorb it into lambda. So, and then lambda is not tau anymore. Okay. Okay. So you can put your particle wherever your particle sits in space. You can put it into the equatorial plane. And you can put its velocity in the equatorial plane. And this equation guarantees that it will never leave the equatorial plane. Now let's look at the variation with respect to phi. The metric is independent of phi. Okay, so we expect a conserved quantity here. And indeed, the equation of motion, when you vary with respect to phi, you see dl d phi is 0, so d by d tau of dl d phi dot is 0. So basically, I have d by d tau of r squared sine squared theta phi dot equals 0. And so we can integrate that immediately to say r squared sine squared theta phi dot equals LZ equals constant. But I picked theta equal to pi over 2. OK, so this is actually just r squared phi dot, since theta is pi over 2. OK, so that has an easy interpretation. That's just the angular momentum of the particle about the z-axis. And it's conserved because the metric is independent of the azimuthal angle phi. So finally, let's vary with respect to t. And again, the metric is independent of t, right? There's no t. The Schwarzschild metric is static, doesn't depend on time at all. And that means there's a conserved quantity. And that's the energy of the particle. So if a metric is independent of time, you always get a conserved energy. And so we get t dot times 1 minus RS over R dot equals 0. And so T dot times 1 minus RS over R equals E equals constant. But now I can use the equation okay, which is conserved. This equation is valid everywhere along the particle geodesic. And so I've got G naught naught here, which is minus 1 minus RS over R. And then I've got T dot, which is E over 1 minus RS over R. Okay, so I have T dot squared, so there are two inverse powers of this. So I end up with that times E squared. That comes from the T dot squared term. And then I have GRR, which is inverse of 1 minus RS over R. So that is plus 1 over 1 minus RS over R. Actually, it's the same as this. So let's write it that way. R dot squared. And then I have plus LZ squared over R squared equals minus 1. For a massive particle. I'm going to leave this up because I'm going to need it again. Okay, so now this is very easy because now I've reduced the problem to a one-dimensional problem, right? Just the motion of R of tau, and I've basically written down a conserved quantity. So I just have to integrate. This gives me a first-order differential equation for R dot as a function of R, and so this is. This is straightforward to solve. Well, let's say straightforward to analyze. Okay, and that is this afternoon's tutorial will be devoted to analyzing this equation. And so how does R evolve given that in tau, given that it satisfies this equation. But I'm going to go ahead now and do light. So the bending of light. And so to do the bending of light, I need to start from an action. So my action is just going to be d lambda over E g mu nu x prime nu. There's no need for a mass anymore. In fact, there's no meaning of a mass. But this action is still valid. And we can still choose E equals 1. Okay. So what I do is I vary with respect to E, and what I'll get is so let's just delta S delta E gives me the equation G mu nu x prime nu equals 0. Okay. And that equation, of course, is completely independent of E. All right. So just delta S by delta E gives me 1 over E squared times this. Has to be 0. So this has to be 0 for any E. And then I'm just free to pick E to be any function I like of lambda, as long as its derivative doesn't vanish anywhere. Okay. In particular, I can just choose E to be 1. That's a valid parameterization of the line. And then delta S delta x equals 0 will give the geodesic equation in the affine parameterization okay, but this time for a photon. So the only difference now is that you have this parameter, lambda, let's say, with the choice made that E equals 1. And lambda doesn't mean the proper time along the path. Proper time is 0 along a photon path. Okay, it's just a parameter. And it's just a parameter you have to live with. In a certain sense, photons don't know about the energy. They don't know about energy. Okay, it's only when you emit a photon or receive it that you actually define an energy for it. I won't really explain that, but just mention it. Photons are a bit different to ordinary particles. That's a consequence of what's called the conformal invariance of the photon action, that you're free to, you see, what's different about a photon is if I have a metric g mu nu, or I replace the metric by any function, if I just replace g mu nu by omega squared of x g mu nu, okay, any positive function of x, I could just replace the metric by this. And then I would just replace E by omega squared E. And these two would cancel for a photon. So photon has no idea about the overall scale of the metric. Its motion doesn't depend on that scale or anything. And when we come to do an expanding universe, the photon doesn't even see the expansion, okay, in its motion. Its energy changes, but that's only because it's emitted or absorbed by a massive particle. And that's the definition of energy. So I won't dwell on this, but photons intrinsically do not have an energy scale associated with them. Okay, so anyway, this is a perfectly valid action. If I vary it, I'll get the geodesic equation for the photon in the affine parameterization. And this condition along the photon trajectory will be preserved. So if I set up a null trajectory and then evolve it, so the velocity satisfies this condition initially, evolve it with the geodesic equation, it will satisfy that condition for all time. So this is the right action, actually, for a photon with the following change, that I just make this lambda. And let's call these primes now, since they're not, this is not proper time. OK, lambda is just an affine parameterization of the photon geodesic. Doesn't have any interpretation as proper time. So exactly the same arguments hold as before, that you can set theta equals pi over 2. That equation was didn't depend on it being a massive particle. You can also define Lz equal to r squared phi prime equals 0. And so there's a conserved angular momentum for the photon. And finally, you can there is a conserved quantity, which you can call E, okay, which looks like this. Sorry, that's not 0. This is conserved. It's constant. And E is equal to this is also constant. OK, so there is a conserved quantity like an energy, but its actual scale doesn't matter, because I could just rescale lambda. Right, if lambda is an affine parameter, then any constant times lambda is also an affine parameter. And so I can just rescale this t prime by rescaling lambda, and E will change. So the actual value of E doesn't matter. Of E is not physical. It depends on the choice of affine parameterization which is arbitrary. Okay, so these are the equations for a photon. In the Schwarzschild metric. And so now what we do, let's work in this plane, theta equals pi over 2. Okay, and imagine we're looking down on that plane from above. So here is some object, mass m, let's say. And imagine I have my photon traveling along in a nearly straight line. Okay, so that that will be the photon, and I'll define the trajectory of the photon by r of phi. Okay, so let's see, this is phi equals 0. This angle is phi. And this length is r of phi, this radius. OK, so phi will run from pi when the photon comes in to 0 when it goes out at infinity. Sorry. Phi in the, yeah, if there was no mass here, if this was just on a perfectly straight line, so the coordinates for a straight line are such that phi goes from pi to to 0 as r goes from infinity to some finite distance and back out to plus infinity. Okay, so now one uses the standard trick from Newtonian mechanics when you solve for the orbits of the planets, which is to consider this radius of phi, but actually do the following. In fact, let me write down the, I need one more equation. I need the g mu nu x prime nu equals 0 for the photon. So let's just write that down. That is 1 minus rs over r, so all the same arguments as we did for the massive particle, e squared with a minus sign, plus 1 minus rs over r inverse r prime squared now, plus lz squared over r squared equals 0. Okay, so that's the equation we want to solve for the photon. Now, the trick here consists of two things. Well, first of all, I'll multiply through by the 1 minus rs over r. Okay, and then I'm going to substitute in for that r prime squared. So r prime squared is dr d lambda squared. But I can convert that into a dr d phi squared by saying that let's just do it for r prime. So r prime is dr d lambda, which is equal to dr d phi d lambda. And d phi d lambda I can solve from this equation. So that is lz over r squared dr d phi. Okay, so I can put that in the bottom equation. And the point of doing that is I get this 1 over r squared, which will cancel that 1 over r squared. Oh, I'm sorry. Don't do that. Just use this formula. And then notice that this is minus du d phi, okay, where u is equal to 1 over r. Okay, so it just turns out it's easier because this r prime comes with the 1 over r squared. It's easier to redefine a variable 1 over r. And so, of course, du is minus 1 over r squared dr. And so then I get that equation. Okay, so this r prime squared is going to turn into du d phi squared. And then I will multiply through by this factor. Now, 1 over r becomes u, so that's good. The u is in the numerator. And 1 over r squared becomes u squared. So if we call this equation star, then star becomes the following. Becomes lz squared du d phi squared is equal to, so I'm just solving for this r prime squared. And so it's equal to e squared. Just taking this term over to the right-hand side. And when I multiply through by this factor, I just get e squared. And then I get minus lz squared u squared, that's the 1 over r squared, times 1 minus rs u. Okay, so that's not too bad. I've just got a cubic now in U on the right-hand side. And now I can differentiate with respect to phi. And what this will give me is d2u d phi squared. So I'm going to differentiate with respect to phi. That will remove the e squared, because that's just a constant. And the du d phi I'm going to cancel on both sides, and the lz squared as well. And so this will give me d2u d phi squared plus u is equal to 3 over 2 rs u squared. Okay, so what did I do here? I differentiate with respect to phi. So here I've got 2 lz squared u du d phi d2u d phi squared. The e's gone. The lz squared I get, so that'll cancel this l squared. This term I'll get equals minus 2 lz squared u du d phi. And this last term I've got u cubed, so I'm going to get plus 3 lz squared u squared, lz squared rs u squared du d phi. Okay, so I'm going to cancel the lz squareds, cancel the du d phi, and cancel a factor of 2, and I'll get this equation here. Okay, so this equation was derived by Einstein. First time around, as I mentioned, he made a mistake because he didn't know about the second term in the Schwarzschild metric. He just used the first one, and that gave him a factor of 2 wrong in the answer. And so his first answer was actually just the same as the Newtonian answer for a very fast-moving particle, a particle moving at the speed of light. But this is the correct equation. So notice that the right-hand side is small. The right-hand side is small because u is 1 over r. Right. If I compare the right-hand side to the left-hand side, to this term, say, rsu is the ratio. Okay, so that's a dimensionless number. That is rs over r. And that is less than rs over the impact parameter. So b is the impact parameter of the photon. That's the distance of closest approach. And so this would be 2gm over b c squared. Now, the Schwarzschild radius for the sun, I believe, is a centimeter. Okay? It's well inside the sun. So just take gm over c squared for the sun. In fact, we can work it out. Okay, Schwarzschild radius for the sun. So what's g? Does anybody know what g is? SI units, kilograms, meters, seconds. Anybody remember?
6.7 times 10 to the 11.
Very good. Okay, 6.7 times 10 to the minus 11. Factor of 2. What's the mass of the sun? Kilograms. Pardon? 2 times 10 to the 30. Yeah, collectively you know all this. Okay, it's just individually is the problem. Okay. All right, C is 3 times 10 to the 8, so square it, we get 10 to the 17. Let us approximate 2 times 6.7 is about 10. So that is 10 to the minus 10. Forget about the 2. And so we've got 10 to the minus 20 over 10 to the 17. Sorry, 10 to the plus 20 over 10 to the 17. So that's a kilometer. Sorry, not a centimeter, a kilometer. For the Earth, it's a centimeter. What? Oh, it's 3 kilometers. Well, if we just did the numbers right, we would. Factor of 2 gives us the we're close. So that's the Schwarzschild radius for the sun is a kilometer. It's well inside the sun. Okay. So what it means is if I took all the mass of the sun and I squished it down to a radius of 1 kilometer, then it would form a black hole. Okay. But so obviously this number, the impact parameter, is bigger than the radius of the sun. I mean, the photons going past the sun. So impact B has to be bigger than the radius of the sun. This is only a kilometer. OK, so this is a tiny number. OK, so that means that in this equation, this right-hand side is really tiny compared to the U on the left-hand side. And so that means that to solve it, so we can solve perturbatively. Okay, we can solve perturbatively. So in order to have a perturbative solution to any problem, you have to have a small dimensionless parameter. Okay, if you don't have a small dimensionless parameter, you can't use perturbation theory. But we do have a small dimensionless parameter, which is just RS times U. So first of all, we neglect it. So first, neglect the right-hand side. And then we find that that U is equal to U is just sinusoidal. And so U will be 1 over B sine phi. OK? So obviously, setting the left-hand side to 0 means that U is a sum of a sine and a cosine with arbitrary coefficients. But I can fix the coefficients by saying that U goes to 0 as phi goes to 0, right? That's when the particle's gone past the star. U goes to 0 when phi goes to pi, because that's when r is infinity, when phi is pi. And the distance of closest approach is b. Okay, so that's because U goes to 0 as phi goes to 0 or pi, and U equals 1 over b when phi is pi over 2. So that's the equation for the photon when I ignore the effect of gravity. The effect of gravity is in the right-hand side here. And so what I say is that this is U0. This is the zeroth order solution. So I substitute U is U0 plus U1. U0 solves this equation. This the left-hand side is 0. And then the U1 I balance against U0 on the right-hand side. So I have d2 u1 d phi squared plus u1 is equal to 3 halves rs u0 squared, OK, this is 2 leading order in RSU. Okay, so to solve it perturbatively, I first ignore this term because it was small, find the zeroth order solution, and then I plug in this expression. So U0 is a big thing, U1 is a small thing, put it on the left-hand side, U1 is not gives me some contribution. On the right-hand side, I get something from the U0. And then I just have to solve this equation for U1. Okay, so this is equal to 3 halves, 1 over b squared, sine squared phi. Sine squared phi is 1 minus cosine 2 phi. And then I have to integrate that equation. And the solution is that U1 is equal to 3 halves Rs over b squared, 1 plus 1 third cosine 2 phi. OK, so we can check that's true, because if I differentiate this u1 twice, I'm just going to get this cosine term with a factor of 4 and a minus sign. So I'm going to get a minus 4 thirds times the cosine with this coefficient. Plus u1, I'm just going to add this term again. So I'll get this with the minus 4 thirds. So I'll get 1 minus cosine 2 phi, which is exactly what I need to balance the right-hand side. And so the solution is u is 1 over b sine phi plus 3 halves rs over b squared, 1 plus 1 third cosine 2 phi plus higher order in rs over r over b. So this term is the leading order in RS over B. Yeah?
Because you wrote 1 minus cos 2 phi, I think we're supposed to have a factor of 2 here.
Oh, good point. Yeah, good point. Good point, sorry. That's a 4. And that is also a 4. Yeah, thanks for that. I switched the notation. It's because the RS had a factor of 2 in it, and I was just switching the notation without. Okay, any other questions?
Okay, so that's our solution to leading order in RS over B. And now we just have to look, what does this trajectory look like? And so let me sketch it.
We've got the mass m sitting here. And so you see what happens is that as phi goes to pi, this gives me a minus. Sorry, as phi goes to pi, that gives me a plus. So basically, I'm adding a little bit to u. Yeah, is that? I don't think that's a good way of looking at it. No, I'm sorry. U is going to 0 because r is going to infinity. Okay, so the photon is going off to infinity. So the point is, if u equals 0 in the unperturbed trajectory, if I ignore this term, u equals 0 is where phi is 0 or pi. That's the, so pi is when it's coming in and 0 is when it's going out. U equals 0 in the perturbed trajectory, I've got to solve this equation equals 0. Okay. So phi is slightly different than 0 or pi. And so basically what it looks like is this. The curve looks like that. I've exaggerated it. And the angle you go out with here, So this is as u goes to 0, because r, u is 1 over r. R is going to infinity. So u is going to 0. We have to solve this equation. We've got to solve 1 over b. Now, phi is small. Okay, so that this angle is phi. So phi is certainly small. But 1 over b times phi plus rs plus 3 quarters rs over b squared, I'm allowed to put phi equals 0 in this formula, because that is the, I can put the unperturbed solution in there. And now I'll get 4/3 equals 0. So that means that phi is equal to minus rs over b. Okay, so basically this angle here is rs over b. And likewise, if we figure out the deflection over here, we would this would be this would also be rs over b. Okay, so the photon comes in and leaves at an angle with respect to the straight line. And the total deflection, delta phi, is equal to twice rs over b. Okay, so the light is bent towards the sun, and the total deflection is twice rs over b. And so that's actually equal to 4g m over b c squared. If you put the numbers in, that is 1.75 arc seconds times the radius of the sun divided by b. Okay, so all I'm doing here is calculating this number where, if this quantity b was replaced by the radius of the sun, and then it's equal to that times the radius of the sun over b. So the biggest angle you can get is when b is equal to the radius of the sun. Okay, are there any questions about this?
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I'll draw it again. It's okay. Let me draw it again. So let's consider the straight line is the first term. Okay, so this is
zeroth order. U equals 1 over b sine phi. Let's see if we can prove that. So that is b. Okay. R is this distance, and this angle is phi. Okay? So just by geometry, sine phi is equal to b over r. Okay? And so this is saying that u is equal to 1 over b sine phi. Okay, so that's a straight line in those coordinates. So now what I do, so that's the zeroth order thing. Okay? But I want to know, what does this one look like? So the way to figure that out is to say, well, obviously r is going to go off to infinity. I mean, this photon may be bent, but it's always going to end up at infinity. So this is going to go to 0. So how far am I deflected? Well, I have to balance this term against that. So here I will use phi to first order. Here I'll use phi to zeroth order. So to zeroth order, because this coefficient is small. So to zeroth order, phi goes to 0. So this goes to 4/3 And this reduces to 1 over b sine phi 1. OK? And so from this, I get that phi 1 is a negative number. OK, so this is the first order deflection. And as I follow the particle, it's going to go down this line, OK? And as I define my phi, I'm going to head towards exactly the same angle. OK, so the phi is going to be here. And so this is my phi 1, which will be minus rs over b. And likewise, coming out this way, do the same calculation, and you'll find that phi here, well, this total angle, I guess, is going this way. OK, so the total phi will be pi plus rs over b. Are there any other questions? OK, so this prediction was made by Einstein in 1911 when he corrected his factor of 2. And if you do the same calculation in Newtonian gravity, you'll get 2gm over bc squared. Okay. So this was the great prediction. The general relativity predicted a 4, and Newtonian theory predicted a 2. So Arthur Eddington, who was Britain's leading astronomer of the time, decided to organize 2 expeditions. And one went to Brazil in a place called Sobral. And Eddington himself went to Principe. I think I said Guinea-Bissau last time. It's not true. It's actually, is it Sao Tome and Principe? It's a former Portuguese colony. You should know, yeah? Sorry. Say it again.
São Tomé. Prince. Okay. Somewhere near Guinea. Okay, it's basically on the equator. So the reason he went to, the expeditions went there is
there was a solar eclipse. So the shadow of the shadow cast by the moon was traveling across the Earth, and it went past this place. It blackened out this place in Brazil, and then it went to Sao Tome and Principe, a little island. And so Eddington went there and made measurements, and he claimed to confirm that the stars behind this visible just outside the sun, okay, as the sun was blacked out by the moon, you could see that you measured the positions of the stars in a photographic plate, and then you compared it with the photographic plate when the sun was not in front of the stars, and you found that the positions on the sky of the stars had moved. And he claimed it had moved by an amount consistent with Einstein and not with Newton. Okay, so then there was a huge fuss this was in 1919, huge fuss in the newspapers. The New York Times has a headline, which I have here, it says, "Lights all askew in the heavens." Okay. And then men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observations. Einstein theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or were calculated to be, but nobody need worry. Okay, that's a headline. Okay. And it was rather nice because in London, the Illustrated London News said, "A new theory of the universe, the brainchild of a German Jew working in Berlin, had been confirmed by an English Quaker," because Eddington was a Quaker, "on a small African island." Okay. Anyway, so you think there's hype these days. It was nothing compared to those days. So that was a great triumph. And really, after the precession of Mercury, which I told you about before, so precession of Mercury was a postdiction, okay, therefore less impressive. I mean, the observation result was known. Einstein's theory came along and fit it. But that was after the fact. It wasn't a prediction. So this was actually a prediction. Now, whether Eddington really measured the factor of two is very open to debate. Okay, the quality of his photographs was very fuzzy. And Eddington was a theorist. Okay, so right there, you should question whether he really got it right. And people who've looked carefully at his data cannot believe how he managed to claim there was this factor of two confirmed. But anyway, he was right. And now it's confirmed at very high precision that this effect really exists. Okay, so I'm going to let's see, what am I going to do next? I think I'm going to go on to, how much time have we got? Yeah, I think I'm going to do one little topic, which is to discuss how you go from particles to fields, okay, in the context of general relativity. Okay, so we've talked about particles, but as I've said several times, particles are really just a manifestation of fields. I mean, what is a photon? A photon is a quantum of light. But it's a quantum of the electromagnetic field, right? And the electron is a quantum of the Dirac field. So I've mentioned this before, that the more fundamental viewpoint seems to be, or at least seemed to be, until recently perhaps, that the fundamental entities were not particles, but were fields. So I just want to show how do I go from a particle to a field in the context of general relativity. Okay, and the way we do this is through quantization. And so I'm going to just give you a glimpse of this quantization. How do you actually quantize a relativistic particle in a gravitational field? And from this, we will get the field equation for the field described associated with the particle. So let's begin again with this action I gave you for the particle, g mu nu x prime mu over E minus E. So and the integral is over lambda. And now the first step in quantization is to work out what the canonical momenta are, okay, the p's conjugate to x. Because the canonical route to quantization is to impose the commutation relations between P and X, which I'm sure Ben has talked a lot about. Has Ben talked about that? A little bit? P with X is minus H minus has he discussed this? Not really? Okay. Well, this you probably are familiar with. Are you familiar with this equation? That when you write down the Schrodinger equation, what you do is get the Hamiltonian, and then you substitute in for the momentum that I replace it with this gradient. And the canonical route to quantization is basically to consider P as an operator, and that operator doesn't commute with x, it actually satisfies this equation. Okay, so we're going to follow the same route for a relativistic particle in a space-time metric. So this is, it's kind of tricky because we're actually going to be considering the time of the particle also to be as a coordinate, which is also going to get quantized, and and we'll impose these commutation relations and see what happens. So what is the canonical momentum? Momentum conjugate to x mu. So p mu is equal to the variation of the action with respect to the velocity. Okay, so that's always how you calculate momentum. I use this notation, by the way. This just means vary the action, compute the coefficient of delta x dot nu under the integral, and that's what this is. So all I have to do, sorry, x prime mu. So I'm thinking here of lambda as the time. So lambda is the time, not the coordinate x naught, but lambda. Lambda is the sort of time in this one-dimensional universe, that is the particle's trajectory. So p mu is just the variation of the action with respect to x prime, x mu prime. And so this is m. I get a factor of 2 because there are two x primes. So I get m g mu nu x prime nu over e. So that's the canonical momentum. And when I vary with respect to e, of course, as we've already discussed, we get this equation g mu nu x prime nu equals over e squared equals minus 1. And that equation just reads, you see, so here I can solve for the velocity. X prime nu is the velocity of x. I can solve for the velocity in terms of p by just inverting the metric. Okay, so this gives me x prime mu is equal to g mu alpha p mu over m. And I guess there's an e. Okay, so by the way, the metric always, the momenta always comes with a downstairs index as a, when you derive it this way, because the x prime mu is downstairs in that formula. So that's the formula for the velocities in terms of the metric. Metric is a function of x and the momentum. So now I plug in for x prime mu, and what I'll find is that g mu nu p mu p nu is equal to minus m squared. Okay, so that's good because it tells you that this is basically the analog of the special relativistic equation, p naught squared minus vector p squared equals to m squared. This is also called the mass shell condition. Okay, so we say that if this equation is true, then the momentum and the energy are, then the four momentum, I should say, is on mass shell. Okay, so that's good. The canonical momentum looks like a sensible thing. Looks like the four momentum we expect for the particle. And now what we do in the canonical formalism is work out the Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian is defined to be the sum of the momenta times the velocities. Okay, and notice the momentum has a downstairs index. So when I sum it with the velocities, I don't need any metric there. There is no metric. It's just summing the momenta times the velocities minus the Lagrangian density, Lagrange density. That's the definition of the Hamiltonian. And if you work it out, you'll get E over M G mu nu P nu plus M squared. Okay, but if I use this equation, the constraint, that's equal to zero. So the Hamiltonian for a relativistic particle is zero, okay, when you use the constraint. Okay, so this constraint should be thought, this is an equation which follows from the variation of the action, so you can think of it like an equation of motion. But as long as the equation of motion is satisfied, Hamiltonian is zero. So at first sight, this seems strange. A relativistic particle has zero Hamiltonian. But in fact, this is always true. For systems with time reparametrization invariance. Okay? And that's not hard to prove, that if you have any action in which the time, here lambda is the time, in which the action is invariant under reparametrizing the time, replacing lambda with any function of lambda, then the Hamiltonian has to be zero. Okay, that isn't hard to prove. And in fact, in particular, it's true for GR. So GR is a theory of space-time, and so it's a theory of G mu nu of X, and I can do the canonical formalism for GR and work out its Hamiltonian and et cetera, et cetera, and I'll find the Hamiltonian is zero for general relativity as well. Yeah. No, this is the time.
Right, okay, so the
time. No. Exactly. Exactly. In non-relativistic, it's not time reparametrization invariant. Okay, so when I do a non-relativistic particle, then I really do, you know, an action like kinetic energy, x dot squared, that's d by dt. Minus v of x. So that's the, and this is not invariant. Exactly. Then it would vanish. Yeah. So the only way to get it to be time reparametrization invariant is, well, first to have this funny field E, okay? Or alternatively, you see, I could have done this very, if you didn't like the E, you could deal with the square root action. And this was also reparametrization invariant. X prime mu x prime lambda, because there's only kind of one power of d lambda in the denominator here and one there. So that's also reparametrization invariant. So when you have, now in fact, so what this means is when I write down the Schrodinger equation, what is the Schrodinger equation? Well, it's I h bar d by dt equals psi. Equals h psi. That's the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so now here, t is really lambda. And the right-hand side is zero. So it's saying that the wave function doesn't depend on lambda. Now that's a good thing, because lambda is not a physical quantity. I mean, I could always reparameterize this, so it would be sort of crazy if the wave function did depend on, was a particular function of lambda.
For a linear motion.
time if I need to see something like that.
Okay, so when I write down an action, in general, for a mechanical system, it's an integral dt of a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian, so the action in general, what is an action? An action is an integral over some time of a Lagrangian, which is a function of x of t and x dot. And that's sort of, well, actually, you can have higher derivatives too, but for simplicity, let's consider actions like this. So that's a general action. Now, if it is true, so let me try to reparameterize the trajectory. What does that mean? The reparameterization means that instead of x of t, I'll have x s twiddle, or s prime, will be integral dt prime of the Lagrangian x of t prime, and then dx dt prime of t prime. Okay, that's what I would mean by the primed action. Okay? I have some new t prime, and I consider the coordinate to be a function of, in fact, I want it, it'll be the coordinates as a function of t prime. The primed coordinates as a function of t prime. And then the statement that it's reparameterization is that this equals that for any t prime of t. This is identical to that. Okay, so you can think of, I mean, just like we did tensor calculus on space-time, you could think of this as doing tensor calculus on the curve x of t. And the coordinate transformations are just changing you from one time coordinate to another time coordinate. Okay, but from this point of view, you can see, okay, what can you see? Yeah, I don't think I can add too much. Okay, so these relativistic Hamiltonians are very special. They are invariant under time reparameterizations, and the Hamiltonian vanishes. And so what is this wave function? Okay, well, the wave function satisfies h phi equals 0. So let's try to work out what is the wave function. Okay, so that wave function looks like this. Plus m squared. And now this is when we quantize. So canonical quantization I want to have these equations satisfied. Delta mu nu. As I said, p has a lower index, x has an upper index. When I commute them, I want to get ih bar. And so that tells me that p mu is ih bar d mu, p by dx mu. Yeah, the minus sign, am I going to be careful about it? Yeah,
Yeah, but there's a compensating fact. You see, when we do, okay, that's true. Xj, that should be definitely minus ih bar delta ij. No, I think that's right. Okay, so this is the correct statement. There's a minus sign in here. And so this turns into g mu nu minus h bar squared d by dx mu d by dx nu plus m squared psi equals 0. Okay, so that's the equation for a relativistic wave function. Now, I cheated. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, good. That's exactly the question I wanted. The point is that quantization is ambiguous. Canonical quantization is ambiguous. Why? Because I do not know whether I should put the p mu on the right. You see, this guy depends on x. But I don't know if I should put the p on the right or on the left. And they're different. Okay? So this prescription for canonical quantization, just replace p by an operator that satisfies this, is not complete. Okay? In general, there are ordering problems. This is not covariant. Okay? And in fact, the ordering is ambiguous. The ordering of p mu and g mu nu is, or g, I guess one has lowered an index, is ambiguous. So what do you want? Well, obviously, when you quantize, you want to quantize in a way that's independent of coordinates. Okay? So you better choose an ordering here which is covariant. Okay? And in fact, that is the principle which determines the ordering. Okay? So we're going to select the ordering. So select the ordering, or an ordering, of p mu, and g mu nu, which yields a covariant equation for psi. Okay, so that's good, that the ordering ambiguity can actually be resolved. And in fact, the way you resolve it is a little bit tricky. You need to use this ordering. So I'm going to say this ordering is wrong because I put the p's on the right. And so what we actually need to use is the following ordering, 1 over root minus g. I'll have my minus h bar squared d by dx mu root minus g, g mu nu d by dx nu acting on psi. Sorry, that's this plus m squared. Okay, so that looks a little bit strange, but remember the d by dx mu is just the p nu. So I've decided to put my p nu there, then my g, and then I've just thrown in this function of g. I'm allowed to do that. Okay, throw it in there, throw its inverse in there. Okay, and so this is just an ordering of p and g. Okay, but of course the reason I do all this is because this is just minus h bar squared times the Laplacian. D- those are the covariant derivatives. Okay, and then this field equation is called the Klein-Gordon equation. And this is actually the correct equation. This is the correct equation for a scalar field psi in curved spacetime. Okay, so this is actually how you derive the Klein-Gordon equation from the action of a relativistic particle. You quantize the particle, and the field, relativistic field, can be thought of as the wave function of the particle. A lot of issues arise later on with the interpretation of this field. In fact, you have to go through second quantization and so on and so forth. But this is the route to work out the right field equation. In the last lecture this week, we're going to do the same procedure, but for the universe. Okay? So we'll have a universe which has a scale factor. It has a metric, and the metric has a scale factor. And I think your homework was about a metric with a scale factor. So we'll write down the action. We'll work out the canonical momenta. We'll work out the Hamiltonian. It's zero, because the universe is time reparameterization invariant. And then we'll work out this equation. And this equation is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for the universe, and that describes the quantum mechanics of the whole universe. Okay? And people are still struggling with the interpretation of this equation. It seems to be a valid equation, but we're not quite sure what it means. Okay. Are there any other questions? Yep. No.
not that so. I mean, people write down a formal expression, but it's not clear it makes any sense. This is, of course, very formal. By the way, let me mention one other, I've ignored one ambiguity here. If I was writing down a scalar equation for a scalar field, psi, which is a scalar field, function of x, I could have actually added one other term and have this still be a covariance equation, a general coordinate invariant equation. Can you think of any other term I could have added in this equation, and it still be, and it still be generally covariant? What else could I add under here? So I'm sitting in some metric. Okay. What other term could I add to this equation?
Something like g mu nu x mu x mu.
No, because. X is not a tensor. X is not a tensor, right? Because X prime mu is some function of X, but it's not equal to dx prime mu dx alpha times X. That's not a correct equation. So the coordinates are not tensors. They transform, but they themselves are not tensors. So I've got to write down something under this bracket that is invariant under coordinate translations, like m squared. So it's a number. It's the same in all coordinate systems. What's a quantity that's the same in all coordinate systems? And it depends on the metric.
Scalar curvature.
Scalar curvature. Okay. So you could actually, if you want, put in another term here, plus some parameter, just some number, times the scalar curvature. And that would still be a covariant equation. And so when you asked about half integrals, Even if you do the path integral for a relativistic particle, it turns out the measure in the path integral is ambiguous. Okay? And different choices of measure give you different numbers for that parameter. Again, one of them is kind of special, it's extra symmetry, but there are some ambiguities which arise when you quantize a particle in a curve, in a curved space time, and one of them is this number. And we still, in many cases, you don't know what that number should be. So when we write down the standard model, a field like this will be the Higgs field that breaks, it is a scalar field, and it breaks electroweak symmetry. But we still don't know what the coupling of this to the Higgs field is. It's ambiguous with our current level of understanding.
Yep.
You say we could have this term. Are we sure that there aren't any other terms that we're not aware of?
No. There could be many other terms, okay? So we could add R mu mu R in here. You could add higher, any scalar function of higher derivatives of metric would also be okay. The only argument for excluding them is that they're small in magnitude. More derivatives you have, the more inverse powers of the length scale. So if the metric is smoothly varying, those terms are small. But we don't have any reason. So, for example, in string theory, which is a completely different approach to quantum field theory, but actually, not completely. String theory is very much like this. Okay, I start with a relativistic string, and then it's a little bit more complicated than a particle because it now has a coordinate around the string. And then I work out the Hamiltonian, and I find it's zero. And then I work out the field equation for the string, which is like this equation, but now it's actually a functional equation. It's not just a partial differential equation. And then you try to approximate this equation as a derivative expansion. And you find that the string actually has all these terms, but in some very prescribed magnitude. And what fixes them is the symmetry under reparameterizing the string. The same kind of coordinate there. So it's kind of like we went to this formula for the, we decided this was unacceptable, so we just reordered this and put in some root minus g's to make it covariant. You do the same thing for the string. You have to order your operators that appear in the string field, what is called the string field equation, and in such a way that it's invariant under all the symmetries you want to preserve. So these kind of principles are exactly the ones we use to fix the predictions of the theory. Are there any other questions? Good. All right. See you later.
Okay, the lunch is here. It is ready. We will start in 1 hour from now.